new threat. Arcturus saw the vulture they'd saved earlier streak toward the walker. Streams of grenades launched from the hover cycle's frontal section, and a series of explosions burst around the Goliath. It wasn't enough, and Arcturus saw that the pilot had doomed himself in his noble attempt to save them. Then a missile streaked past him and slammed into the pilot's compartment of the enemy walker. As the missile exploded, fire blossomed from the machine, and it toppled to the ground in a blazing mass of buckled metal. Arcturus twisted and saw one of his own Goliaths, the blue and red of the Confederate flag, a welcome sight on its front glacis. Smoke trailed from its Hellfire missile launchers, and Arcturus let out a shuddering breath at how close they'd come to death. The vulture pilot looped his vehicle around and sped off into the thick of the fighting without waiting for any thanks.
"Sir!" shouted a voice through the smoke and confusion. "Sir, are you all right?"
He looked up and saw Dia DeSanto, the faceplate of her helmet cracked and scorched. Blood streamed down her arm where her armor had been penetrated, and he saw that her eyes had the glassy look of stim use.
"Yes. Yes, dear, I'm fine," he said, pushing himself to his feet.
Chuck Horner ran up to him, his armor similarly dented and battered.
"Holy crap," he said when he saw Mercurio's dead body.
Chun Liang and the Yancey Gray covered their blind spots as Arcturus shook his head and regained his equilibrium.
"What's the plan, Captain?" shouted Horner.
"This here's a real mess now. That idiot Duke really screwed the pooch on this one."
Arcturus nodded and glanced around the ruined corner of the building once again. The interior of the mining complex was a hellish war zone. Marines lay dead and dying as impaler spikes streamed back and forth like horizontal rain. Explosions mushroomed skyward, and fires licked at the edges of the habitation compound. The operation, which had started so simply, had turned into a disaster of epic proportions. Duke and his men had fought their way into and captured one of the strong points, a brutal and heroic action that had probably saved their lives. Gunfire blasted from loopholes, cutting down the armored soldiers who were attempting to rush them. Smoke and flames obscured much of the battlefield, but Arcturus could already see that it was only a matter of time before Duke and his men were overrun. He dropped to one knee and turned back to his own men.
"Sound off," he ordered. "How many have we got?"
Altogether, he had 16 Marines left alive and one Goliath, the other lying in a smoldering heap of flames and popping ammunition. Arcturus hadn't noticed its destruction.
"Charles, do you still have a line open to the dropships?"
"Yeah, but fat lot of good it's going to do us under fire like this," shouted Horner. "Ain't no way those pilots are dumb enough to bring them flying coffins into this shitstorm."
"Tell them if they don't want to be shot by court-martial, they'll come."
"I'll pass that on, but I'm telling you those flyboys ain't that dumb."
"Just do it."
Arcturus opened a link to the surviving Wraith pilot and issued her fresh orders. Thus far, she had kept her altitude high to avoid any more missiles. But that was going to have to change if they were going to get out of this mess. Next, he cycled through the comm channels until he hit upon Duke's.
"Edmund," he said, "this is Mengsk."
"Where the hell are you?" demanded Duke. "We're getting slaughtered here."
Quickly, Arcturus outlined his plan to the besieged captain, who didn't like it, but was at least savvy enough to realize that it was the only way he was going to see another dawn.
"Okay, Mengsk, we'll do it your way. Duke out."
With his orders issued, Arcturus turned back to his Marines and said,
"When I give the word, we're going to move forward and form a corridor between us and Captain Duke. We'll babysit him back out of the complex so the dropships can pick us up. Got it?"
They got it, and he could see a fire ignite in their eyes at the thought of hitting back at these Kalmorians. His earpiece chimed with a shrill buzz, and he turned away from the battle.
Everyone, incoming!
A sudden sonic boom announced the arrival of the Wraith as it roared overhead on a strafing run. A streaming cascade of laser fire tore through the middle of the camp in a storm of high-energy bolts, ripping through dozens of the green-armored soldiers and exploding amongst the trucks carrying the barrels of Vespine gas. One of the trucks detonated in a storm of razor-sharp fragments and spraying gas. Fires ripped through the enemy ranks, and the shooting ceased as men burned and died. A thunderous salvo of air-bursting missiles hammered the enemy ranks, and bodies flew through the air as billowing pillars of smoke and flame erupted skyward.
Now!
Shouted Arcturus, and his marines broke from cover to rush toward Duke's stronghold. With Arcturus leading the way, they formed a cordon of soldiers with gauze rifles blazing to keep the survivors' heads down. Arcturus saw an enemy soldier pick himself up from the ground and shot him through the head with a burst of impaler spikes. More soldiers were climbing to their feet. Wraiths lacked a real punch when engaging ground targets, but the shock and noise of the attack had given them some breathing room. Duke and his men were pouring from the wrecked stronghold to join them, and under the covering fire of the few surviving Goliaths, the Confederate force began to retreat from the ambush. Something exploded next to Arcturus, and he was slammed into the ground. His rifle spun away, and warning lights flashed on the HUD of his visor. A long crack appeared in the plasteel, and the acrid, rotten smell of sulfur clogged his nostrils. He pushed himself to his knees and felt a series of ringing hammer blows on his side. He fell back, seeing a pair of green-armored soldiers advancing toward him. They were good, disciplined soldiers, and walked their spikes into him, keeping him pinned with the weight of fire. More red icons flashed up on his visor, warning of imminent armor penetration. Then one of the enemy soldiers fell, his faceplate a mask of red where a stream of impaler rounds had punched through in one sustained burst. Arcturus looked up to see Chun Liang standing over him. Mayumi pressed tight into his shoulder as he calmly aimed at the second soldier and put him down with another fiendishly aimed stream of spikes. With the immediate threat neutralized, Liang slung his beloved rifle over his shoulder and offered Arcturus his hand.
"With respect, sir, this probably isn't a good time to be having a lie-down."
Arcturus wanted to laugh at the absurdity of this remark, but accepted Liang's hand and hauled himself to his feet. An explosion burst nearby, and no sooner had Arcturus gained his feet than he saw a strange look enter Chun Liang's eyes. A froth of blood sprayed the inside of the man's visor.
"Liang!"
cried Arcturus, now seeing the plate-sized piece of shrapnel embedded in the back of Liang's helmet. As Chun Liang dropped to his knees, he held his rifle out to Arcturus.
"Look after her," said Liang, and pitched over, dead.
Arcturus watched Liang's helmet fill with blood, obscuring the man's features, horrified at the sudden, random nature of his death. He clutched Mayumi tightly to his chest, and with a final glance at Chun Liang's body, turned and ran after his retreating men.
"Captain Mengsk!" shouted a voice in his ear. "This is Lieutenant Wang in Wraith 1, Fox 3, over!"
"What is it, Lieutenant?"
replied Arcturus, running backward and firing Liang's gauze rifle into the regrouping enemy.
"Your dropships are inbound, but you better get your asses moving! I'm picking up a hell of a lot of incoming contacts on your location. Ground and aerial units, big stuff, too. Battlecruiser-sized. Looks like these guys are playing for keeps."
"Understood," said Arcturus. "Can you give us any more cover?"
"I've got fuel and ammo for one more pass," said Lieutenant Wang.
"Then that will have to do. Mang Scout."
Arcturus found himself next to Edmund Duke, the man looking more angry than exhausted by the day's events. Duke looked over at him, glaring in unreasoning bitterness.
You took your damn time, was all he said.
Arcturus bit back an angry retort, as the last of the Goliaths finally toppled, its missiles cooking off in the heat of the explosion and skittering across the ice as they were released from exploding launchers. A vulture smashed into the ice after raking fire from a volley of impalers blew out its engine. The hover cycle exploded into 1,000 pieces as it hit the ice and its pilot bounced across the rocks, every limb in his body broken. Arcturus hoped it wasn't the same pilot who'd helped them earlier. The mining complex was ablaze from end to end, and Arcturus was amazed the whole place hadn't gone up in one enormous explosion. Looking at the towering glacier above the complex, he saw dark shapes against the midnight blue of the sky. Starships. Impossibly huge behemoths of neo-steel descending from the skies on fiery jets like avenging angels. A fleet of ships was coming in over the glacier, and Arcturus knew that the conflict between the Confederacy and the Kalmorians had moved on from skirmishes and raids. This was something much, much bigger. He caught up to the survivors of the attack as the howling, lurching forms of their dropships swooped down into the crater, their pilots braving the storm of enemy fire and the elements to rescue their men. "Angels on our shoulders," said Arcturus, running toward the ramps of the dropships. Arcturus stepped from the reeking, red-lit dropship almost as soon as it touched down on the gridded landing platform of Camp Hastings. Marines staggered from the bloody, smoky interiors to be met by medics and triage attendants. One dropship had crashed during the extraction, but as Arcturus looked along the line of survivors, he was disappointed to see that Duke hadn't been aboard it. The camp was in an uproar, as though someone had run an electric current through the entire staff. Arcturus ripped off his helmet and took a deep breath. Even the foul smell of the air here wasn't as bad as that of the blood and sweat inside his helmet. Chuck Horner, Yancey Gray, and Dia DeSanto marched down the ramp to stand next to him. Horner looked at the rifle Arcturus carried.
"Chun Liang?"
Arcturus shook his head.
"Damn,"
was all Chuck had to say about that. Arcturus ran a hand through his hair, watching as SCVs went about the task of dismantling the base. Ground crews were already dragging refueling lines out to the dropships, and armored Marines were hauling silver steel trunks from the buildings to the large-scale flyers.
"What the hell's going on here?"
asked Yancey.
"Looks like we're bugging out," said DeSanto, "and in a hurry, too."
Arcturus had to agree with that assessment. Everywhere he looked, he saw military personnel breaking down the base, packing up what could be recovered and destroying what couldn't. At the center of this controlled chaos, Arcturus saw Commander Foley, clad in a suit of powered combat armor and directing operations with his customary brusqueness. Arcturus slung Mayumi over his shoulder and marched up to him. Foley saw him coming and nodded curtly.
"Glad you made it out, Minsk."
"Thank you, sir," replied Arcturus. "What's going on?"
"What does it look like? We're pulling out of Onuru Sigma."
"What? Why?"
"Because this conflict just got hot in hell," said Foley. "General Masakai's Kalmorians are bringing in battle cruisers and brigade strength forces to push us off this rock."
"Battle cruisers? Where did they get ships that large from?"
"Don't matter how they got them, they got them,"
snapped Foley as Edmund Duke trudged over to join them. Foley planted his hands on his hips and said,
"Now, you're both here, I can tell you the bad news. Word from on high is that everyone's term of service just got extended, so I sure hope neither of you was planning on seeing home soon."
"Extended?" said Arcturus. "Why?"
"Because, gentlemen, we're now officially at war with the Kalmorian Combine," said Foley.
Chapter 12. Arcturus adjusted the dials at the side of the resonator, wiping a film of moisture from its screen as the green lines of the display shifted and danced. The gravimetric readings were fluctuating, and though he was sure there was a sizable deposit beneath his feet, the machines just weren't confirming what his instincts were telling him. Looking up from the magnetic resonator, Arcturus cast his eyes over the dig site. Situated in one of the deep, mist-shrouded valleys of Pike's Peak, the cleared terrain was dominated by 6 tall drilling rigs that cored the dense rock at the base of the river canyon. Battered hab units and storage bins were scattered across the drier parts of the valley floor, while men in SCVs worked the coring drills and chugging sifters worked night and day to separate what came up, which, so far, was absolutely nothing of worth. Arcturus knew he was risking a lot with this venture, having sunk most of the money he'd made in the last 2 mines into this hunk of rock out in the far reaches of the rim. But so far his intuition, which had served him so well in the past, hadn't uncovered the vast seam of valuable minerals he felt sure was buried far below the regolith. The shallower valleys were paying out for other prospectors, but so far this deep one had failed to yield any treasures. He swore and slammed his palm against the side of the machine as a voice behind him said,
"I keep telling you, Arcturus, there's nothing in this valley worth a damn."
"It's here, dear," said Arcturus, looking up to see Diamond DeSanto watching him, her hands planted squarely on her hips. "I can feel it." Like Arcturus, DeSanto wore the heavy-duty work clothes common to most Outer Rim prospectors. Heavy-weave trousers, a quilted jacket with numerous pockets, and a battered hard hat. She wore her dark hair in dreadlocks now, and had them pulled in a tight ponytail at the base of her skull. DeSanto bent down to examine the resonator as a jerking sine wave wobbled across its display. At last, Arcturus gave up on the magnetic resonator and stood up straight, wincing as sharp pain flared in his lower back.
"Too much bending over," said DeSanto.
"You're probably right," agreed Arcturus, rubbing his hand over his grimy face and then through his hair. There were strands of gray in it now, and he knew there was only going to be more of them in the future. He'd seen Angus on the UNN yesterday, and his father's hair had gone almost completely silver, so he at least knew he'd likely not be bald when he got older.
"You ain't a young man no more," said DeSanto with a smile. "Nearly 30.
"I'm only 28, said Arcturus. "I'm not over the hill quite yet."
"Yeah, but you can see it from here. Soon it'll be all downhill for you."
"You're in a cheery mood today, dear. What's the matter?" DeSanto shrugged, waving a hand at the work going on around them.
"You need to ask?"
"Of course. What's the matter?"
"Look around you, Arcturus," said DeSanto. "We've been here 2 months, and we ain't found a damn thing worth sticking around for. I know you think there's a big score in this valley, but there's nothing here."
"There is, dear, I'm sure of it," said Arcturus. "I can feel it."
"Oh, you can feel it, can you? Then how come the geological mapping, the gravimetric analysis, and the rock assay reports all say the same thing? There ain't nothing here. And you're going to lose everything if we don't cut our losses and move on soon."
Arcturus rounded on DeSanto. "Our losses? I seem to remember it being mostly my money that started this venture, bought all these machines on credit and hired the workers to use them. We made a little on that first venture, enough to pay back our creditors, and a lot on the following one. You've done well for an ex-Marine, dear. But don't think for a minute that you are taking the same risks as me."
"Damn, but you are one selfish son of a bitch, Arcturus Mengsk,"
snapped DeSanto.
I put all my share of those two mines into this one, and I stand to lose as much as you. Man, I figured once we got out of the Marine Corps, you'd become less of an arrogant asshole. But you're getting worse, you know that?
Thank you for your candor, said Arcturus. Now, was there anything specific you wanted, or did you just come out here to berate me?
A little of both, said DeSanto wearily.
Fine. So you have expressed your opinion, said Arcturus. What else was there?
There's a message arrived for you on the VidSys console. Figured you want to know.
Arcturus took a deep breath, fighting down his annoyance at DeSanto's interruption, but knowing, deep down, that she might be right.
Fine, he said at last. Keep working on the resonator. I'll go see what it is.
DeSanto sat behind the surveying equipment's display as he set off toward the central HAB unit, where the crew gathered for meals and relaxation after the day's labors. He turned back as he walked.
Any idea whom the message is from?
He asked, expecting it to be from either his mother or Dorothy.
Signal origin code is Umoja, said DeSanto.
Umoja?
Yeah, some guy called Pastor.
Arcturus shucked off his boots and jacket as he stepped into the entry hall of the HAB unit, letting the flow of dry air cool him down after the humidity of the dig site. As he hung up his hard hat, he saw that his palms were sweating and realized he was apprehensive. What could Aelin Pastor want with him after all these years? It had been nearly a decade since he had seen the man, and their last words were not ones of abiding friendship. Was it perhaps Juliana using her father's console? He hoped not. He'd taken Achtenfeld's advice literally and made a clean break with his previous life when he'd left Korhal all those years ago. Through the hellish years of the Guild Wars, he'd not thought of Juliana or returned home on any of his infrequent periods of leave. Instead, he had entered the Marine Corps study program, earning himself innumerable qualifications in prospecting and mineral exploration in preparation for the day he could stand before Brantigan Foley and resign his commission.
"Damn, but I hate to lose you, Minsk,"
Foley had said when Arcturus slid his discharge papers across the commander's desk.
"The Kelmorians are on the run, and it's only a matter of time until they got no choice but to surrender. You sure you don't want to wait a while, son? You're a colonel now, but they're going to be handing out promotions like party favors when this is all over. You could be a general if you wanted."
"No, sir," said Arcturus. "As appealing as that is, I've done my time and just won out."
"What you gonna do with yourself, Minsk? You're a soldier. You were born to be a soldier. I don't think you've got it in you to be a civilian. Come on, son. The things we've done, the things we've seen, how can you go back to being an ordinary Joe after that?"
"With respect, sir," said Arcturus, "it's because of the things we've done that I'm leaving."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
said Foley, all civility gone. Arcturus sighed.
"I suppose I just don't believe in what we're fighting for anymore."
Foley had glared up at him and, without another word, signed his discharge papers. Arcturus shook off the memory and pushed open the door to the rec room. Inside, conditions were Spartan, the meager furniture battered from the many times it had been shipped around the rim from potential claim to potential claim. In one corner sat an old scene viewer where everyone caught up on the latest broadcasts from the UNN or their favorite holodrama. A number of mismatching chairs were gathered around a chipped formica table, and a pool table, its felt faded and duct-taped, sat in the corner. Beyond a bead curtain was a small kitchen unit, and a communal ablutions block lay at the far end of the quarters, where Arcturus and a number of others slept and kept their few personal belongings. Against the far wall was the VidSys console, a battered unit they'd bought second-hand and that had never quite functioned as the cellar had promised. But it was serviceable enough, and Arcturus had enough technical savvy to keep it running and allow his prospecting crews some fleeting contact with their homes. A blinking red light flashed on the grimy, oil-stained panel of the console, and Arcturus set himself on the stool before it. Taking a moment to compose himself, he ran his hand through his hair once more and wiped the worst of the grime from his face as he always did before opening any communication. An unnecessary ritual, since the message would have been pre-recorded, but Arcturus never liked to begin anything without looking presentable. Satisfied, he punched the red button, and the screen fuzzed with static before a grainy image of a pair of three-pointed stars locked together within a circle flashed on the screen. For all his skill with electronics, Arcturus had never been able to get the color to work properly, but he knew that one of the stars was jet black, the other pure white. This was the planetary icon of Umoja, and Arcturus took a deep breath as the image faded and was replaced with the face of Aelin Pasteur. The man had aged, his face deeply lined and his hairline having receded alarmingly. Arcturus saw the years had been a burden to Aelin Pasteur, and that he carried their weight in his eyes.
"Hello, Arcturus," said Pasteur.
"Aelin,"
replied Arcturus, falling into the habit of most people when viewing such messages and thinking that the other person was actually on the other end of the link.
"It's been some time since we spoke, so I'll keep this brief."
The man might be looking aged, but his voice had lost none of its strength, and Arcturus was quietly impressed as Pasteur continued.
"Your mother told me you'd left the Marine Corps, and that you're working your way along the Outer Rim territories as a prospector. Well, you always said that's what you wanted to do, so I suppose that counts for something. But a lot of things have changed since you left your old life behind, Arcturus. Things you need to face up to. I haven't contacted you before now because Juliana asked me not to, but, like I said, things have changed."
Arcturus's brow furrowed at Pasteur's words. What had changed?
"I need you to come to Umoja," said Pasteur. "I know you probably won't want to, but I'm appealing to any shred of humanity you might have left in you. Come to Umoja, Arcturus, as soon as you can."
The image of Pasteur faded from the screen, and Arcturus chewed his bottom lip as he considered what he'd just heard. He replayed the message twice more, searching for the meaning lurking behind Pasteur's words. But he could detect nothing beyond their face value. He shook his head and went into the kitchen to fix a hot drink, and armed with a tin mug of steaming military-grade coffee, he made his way to his quarters. Something had changed, and it was something he was going to have to face up to. What in the world could it be? The room Arcturus had taken within the HAB unit gave a narrow window into his personality. He kept it as clean as was possible in a prospecting camp, which wasn't very clean at the best of times. A narrow cot bed sat against one wall, with a gunmetal gray footlocker at its end. Bundles of clothes in need of washing were piled at the foot of the bed, and a number of disassembled pieces of electronic kit lay strewn on a collapsible table in the corner. The walls were largely bare steel, though one wall had a gleaming gauze rifle hung on cloth-wrapped bolts, and another boasted a collection of curling holographic images tacked to it. In one of these images, Dorothy waved to him and blew him a kiss. The image had been captured on her 13th birthday, and a cake bedecked with candles flickered in the foreground. Dorothy was fast becoming the apple of every Sterling lad's eye, with boys from all the moneyed families queuing up to court her, only to be sent packing by her father and told to come back when she turned 21. He reached out and touched the image, as he always did, and scanned the other images, one of him at the graduation ball with Juliana, another of being presented as Colonel Stripes by Brantigan Foley, and one of him standing heroically atop the glittering seam of minerals at his first strike. The final image displayed the entire Menksk family, standing on the balcony of the Menksk Sky Spire. In this picture, Arcturus had just turned 13, and his parents stood proudly behind him, his mother holding baby Dorothy in her arms. Sterling silver towers spread out in back of them. It was the last time Arcturus could remember being truly happy. He cleared a space on the bed and sat on the lumpy mattress, with his back resting on the wall upon which hung the rifle. Arcturus sipped his coffee and winced as it burned his tongue. He put the cup down to let it cool and reached up to lift the gauze rifle from the wall. Mayumi, Chun Liang's weapon. He'd been reluctant to part with it after he'd left the Marines, feeling that it would be somehow wrong to simply get rid of it or pass it on to someone else. He'd kept the weapon clean and maintained it as best he could, but he knew it was a far cry from the immaculate condition it had formerly known. Arcturus worked the action and began to disassemble the weapon for cleaning as he thought back to the soldiers who had served under him in the CMC. Despite the constant reminder of DeSanto's presence, he hadn't consciously thought of Dominion Section for some time, their faces growing hazy in the labyrinth of his memory. Chun Liang and Toby Mercurio had fallen on Onuru Sigma, killed as much by Duke's headstrong foolishness as the Kelmorian trap. And Yancey Gray died on Artesia Prime when their convoy had been attacked by a chittering wave of spider mines erupting from the ground. The lad's legs had been vaporized in the blast, and not even the skill of the combat medics could save him. He died screaming in the back of a truck sloshing with blood. Only Chuck Horner and Dia DeSanto had survived to reach the end of their extended service, along with Arcturus. As Arcturus had expected, Dia mustered out and chose to accompany him to the Outer Rim territories and help him pursue his dreams of becoming a prospector. She had invested what little money she'd saved while still in the service, and had become a pretty damn good prospector, with a nose for when a find was going to pay out and when it wasn't. What else am I going to do? Go back to Tirador 9 and work for rich folks? Not this lifetime, she'd said when he'd once asked her why she'd followed him out of the Marine Corps. He suspected that wasn't the full story, but hadn't pressed her for details. Chuck Horner had chosen a civilian life, and Arcturus was glad his second-in-command, who'd reached a captain's salary by the time he left, had come through the wars unscathed. Horner had married a woman he'd met on leave, and they planned to start a new life together. Arcturus had shaken Chuck's hand and wished him luck.
"Thanks, sir," said Chuck, as they parted on the docks above the gas giant Dylar IV. "I reckon we could all do with a little extra luck now. My own self, I done believe I used a whole lot more than I can expect to see during this war, so any extra you got's gratefully received. Me and Carla are gonna head out to Marsara, see if we can make life for ourselves. She's a bit young and idealistic, but I guess we all were once."
Arcturus never saw Chuck Horner again. Captain Emelian had, of course, remained with the Marine Corps, but Arcturus had no idea what had become of her since his departure. Despite her talk of hunting handsome doctors, Arcturus knew Emelian was a career soldier, and would no doubt see out her days in the military, either dying on some nameless battlefield
or mustering out on retirement. The odds were vastly in favor of the former. But if anyone could buck those odds, it was Angelina Emelian. Arcturus and Dia De Santo had taken a ship out to the Outer Rim territories and set up their prospecting and mining enterprise. Taking jobs the bigger outfits didn't like the look of for one reason or another, and had quickly made a name for themselves as skillful and dedicated players. Their first strike had enabled them to clear their debts and acquire bigger, more powerful drilling machines, as well as more advanced survey equipment. Their second strike had been considerably larger and netted them a hell of a payday, but interference from both the Kelmorian Combine and the Confederate Exploration Corps had become too onerous, and Arcturus had sold the claim for a small fortune and headed farther out into space. The worlds at the very edge of the Outer Rim were less frequented and offered the potential for even bigger unclaimed strikes. But by the same token, they were more isolated and vulnerable to piratical bands or heavily armed competition. With the money they'd made in their second strike, Arcturus and De Santo had bought an old starship named the Kitty Jay and filled her with fresh equipment, skilled workers, SCVs, and even a handful of ex-Marines for protection. They had come to Pike's Peak on the strength of prospectors' tales and an old assayer's report Arcturus had found buried within the data architecture of a forgotten Confederate database. De Santo had balked at risking everything on such scant information, but Arcturus had been insistent, and his instincts had never been proved wrong. Yet. For, as had been pointed out so bluntly to him not 20 minutes ago, they had found nothing of worth here, and unless they hit pay dirt soon, their dwindling capital would soon be exhausted. It was a depressing thought, and Arcturus pushed it aside as he worked an oiled rag along the length of the gauze rifle. The weapon was as clean as it was going to get, and he began reassembling it, wondering if he'd be called to use it to defend this claim. The Guild Wars, as the UNN snappily called it, was entering its fourth year, and from what Arcturus had seen of the fighting, he knew that Brantigan Foley was right. The Kelmorians were going to lose. It remained to be seen what that meant for smaller outfits like his, but Arcturus suspected that it wouldn't take long for the Confederacy to turn its attention to the unclaimed resources of the Outer Rim. Arcturus snapped the last piece of the weapon into place and clicked the magazine home. He laid the rifle across his knees and leaned his head back against the wall, looking over the holographs opposite him. He looked at the image of Juliana and himself smiling for the holocam, and smiled at the memory, wondering what Aelin Pasteur could want with him. It likely wouldn't be anything to do with his family, or he'd have heard from his mother or Dorothy. Perhaps something had happened to Juliana. But then, why would Pasteur turn to Arcturus? He didn't yet know whether he'd even heed the request to travel to Umoja. He owed Aelin and his daughter nothing, and had no obligation to make such a journey. But a nagging curiosity gnawed at the back of his mind. His train of thought was interrupted as he heard running footsteps along the corridor outside and the sound of Diamond De Santo calling his name. He lifted the rifle and placed it beside him on the bed as De Santo burst into his room, her eyes alight with excitement and the breath heaving in her lungs.
"Holy hell, Arcturus, you need to get your ass outside now!"
"What is it? What's going on?"
"You were right," gasped De Santo. "God damn it, but you were right! It's unbelievable!"
"Slow down, Dia," said Arcturus, swinging his legs off the bed and standing up.
De Santo threw herself at him, embracing him in a crushing bear hug. Arcturus prized her grip from around his neck and held her at arm's length.
Listen to me, dear. Slow down. What are you talking about? What's unbelievable?
She took several calming breaths before speaking, but Arcturus saw the thrill in her eyes and felt an electric sense of excitement pass between them.
The claim, said DeSanto. You were right. There's minerals right below us, but we couldn't see them. Turns out the resonators were getting some backscatter from a higher stratum of banded ironstone.
Are you sure?
Demanded Arcturus.
Have you checked?
Yeah. One of the drills brought up a core sample that showed a layer of magnetite and shale. Once I adjusted the resonator to filter that out. Oh, man, you gotta see it. It's the biggest deposit I've ever seen. We're rich, Arcturus!
Okay, you need to calm down, dear.
No way, man. This is big, Arcturus. I've never even heard of a seam this huge. It's still going to be paying out when our grandkids are drawing their pensions.
4 days later, and the party still hadn't stopped. If anything, DeSanto had underplayed the scale of the find, and with the resonator properly calibrated to reach beyond the banded ironstone layer, there seemed no end to the length, breadth, and depth of the mineral seam. With Arcturus's confirmation of the veracity of the find, and the first samples brought to the surface, the assembled workers and marines had broken out the alcohol, and the party had begun in earnest. Heavier drilling rigs were even now being built to more quickly exploit the enormous find, and Arcturus knew that this strike was going to make him a very rich man indeed. Richer than any prospector in the history of the Confederacy had ever managed after a lifetime of exploration and digging. The rec room was filled with people, miners, assayers, and soldiers. The heavier drilling rigs were due to go online tomorrow, and the SCVs had made a good start on the construction of an extraction refinery. But tonight, everyone was relaxing. This was likely to be the only time off anyone was going to get in the next few months as they established a more permanent facility on the claim, and everyone was making the most of it. Arcturus sat on one of the chairs around the table, listening to the excited banter of his staff and letting them congratulate him on the intuitive instinct that had led them to this windfall. Everyone expected to get rich from this find, and for once, it looked as though that might actually be the case. Bottles of alcohol were passed around and toasts raised to future fortunes. Arcturus listened to his men's grand plans about how they were going to spend their money and took a proffered mug of lethally strong hooch. Dia DeSanto sat next to him, smiling broadly, and flicking through the few channels they received on the scene viewer. Various images flickered in the corner of the room, adverts mainly, but Arcturus sat up as a familiar face ghosted into focus onto the projection. He read the caption that scrolled along the bottom of the image and said, "Wait," as he saw DeSanto reaching to change the channel. "Turn it up." The speakers crackled and spat, but eventually Arcturus heard his father's voice, though the sound of revelry in the rec room all but drowned him out.
"Quiet!"
barked Arcturus, and the room was instantly silenced. He stood and walked over to stand right in front of the viewer as the caption repeated across the bottom of the screen. "Martial law on Korhal as Senator Angus Mengsk declares war on the Confederacy. Tarsonis promises stern measures of retaliation." On the viewer, Angus stood addressing a thousand-strong crowd from a podium erected on what Arcturus recognized as the Marshall Field. A sea of adoring faces stared up at his father as he held forth on his favorite subject, the rampant corruption of the Confederacy. Though the UNN had muted his words, Angus's fist hammered the air as he spoke, his call to arms answered by deafening cheers from the crowd. Arcturus saw his mother and Dorothy standing proudly behind his father as the announcer spoke disgustedly of planet-wide riots, the capture of the UNN Tower, and attacks on Confederate outposts that had seen thousands dead. The view rotated between Confederate barracks on fire, vast crowds of people on the streets with brightly painted banners, and Angus shouting to the gathered followers like the fiery demagogue of some ancient fire and brimstone faith. Was this the reason Aelin Pasteur had wanted him to travel to Umoja? What did Pasteur know that the UNN wasn't reporting?
"Stern measures of retaliation," he said. What did that mean?
Arcturus turned from the scene viewer and marched down the corridor to his room. He pushed open the door and began packing a bag, stuffing in the few clean clothes he had left. Dia DeSanto pushed into his room seconds later, her face betraying her worry.
"What are you doing, Arcturus?"
"I'm leaving," said Arcturus. "Isn't it obvious?"
"Tell me you're joking. You can't leave now."
"Just watch me."
"We're on the verge of digging out the biggest mineral strike this side of the Long Sleep, and you want to leave? Damn it, Arcturus, we need you here. I need you here."
"Don't worry, Dia," said Arcturus, reaching out and putting a hand on her shoulder. "I'll be back soon. I'm going to take the Kitty Jay to Umoja, but I will be back, I promise."
"Umoja? Why the hell do you need to go there?"
"I need to see Aelin Pasteur," said Arcturus. "Then I need to make sure my family is safe."
Arcturus stepped through a haze of steam and oil smoke onto the surface of Umoja, or at least onto the heat-resistant ceramic landing platform that had just descended a few hundred meters into the surface of Umoja. A drizzle of moisture clung to his skin like humidity, and the heat bleeding from the Kitty Jay's engines warmed the air. Traveling between worlds always made Arcturus uneasy. The unknown dimensions of deep space and all that might lurk in its vast emptiness fired his imagination with images of as-yet-unknown aliens and piratical corsairs. As master of his own destiny, the placing of his fate in the hands of another, even one as qualified as Morley Sanjaya, the pilot he'd hired when he'd bought the Kitty Jay, unsettled him greatly. Though he could not fly a starship, Arcturus felt sure that if he were to try, he would master it quickly enough, and make better time than the 2 weeks it had taken them to get here. Aelin Pasteur's private landing platform was empty, and its underground walls were a mixture of rock and metal, scorched black by the comings and goings of orbital craft. A flashing amber light rotated above a shuttered blast door, and a low buzz of static poured from a speaker recessed in the wall. The light flicked off, and the blast door began to rumble upward. A squad of men clad in combat suits of pale blue plate and carrying gauze rifles marched out onto the platform, followed by a man wearing a dark suit and a foul weather cloak. Aelin Pasteur. The last time Arcturus had seen Pasteur had been at the close of session of the Korhal Senate, where the man had berated him for how he had just treated his mother. With the benefit of hindsight, Arcturus now accepted that his actions might have been a little rash that day, which bought Pasteur some goodwill. Pasteur stopped at the base of the steps that led up to the landing platform. "Hello, Aelin," said Arcturus, slinging his suit bag over his shoulder. "I'd say good morning or good evening, but I don't know which it is."
"It's evening, Arcturus," said Pasteur. "Welcome to Umoja."
Though the words were said with formal politeness, Arcturus sensed the rancor behind them. Was this some charade for the soldiers standing at Pasteur's back?
"Thank you," said Arcturus, stepping down from the platform and waving a hand in the direction of the opened blast door. "Shall we?"
Pasteur nodded and turned on his heel, clicking his fingers at the soldiers, who quickly followed, marching in lockstep behind them. Pasteur led him into a series of rock corridors that looked as though they had been bored through with fusion cutters. Arcturus noted the quality and type of the rock, smiling as he found himself calculating the density of the rock
and rate per hour that it could be excavated. Walking alongside him, Pasteur saw the smile and said,
"Something funny?"
"Not really," said Arcturus. "I still have my prospecting head on. Look, tell me what this is all about, Aelin. My outfit's just struck a huge mineral deposit, and we need to get our operation up and running before the Confederate Exploration Corps gets wind of it. So, come on. What's going on?"
"It's better if you see for yourself," said Pasteur.
Arcturus sighed. "If this has something to do with my family, then I want to know now."
"Oh, it has something to do with your family, all right," snapped Pasteur. "But I promised I wouldn't say anything, and I am a man of my word."
This last comment appeared to be particularly barbed, and Arcturus wondered what he had done to deserve such animosity. But Pasteur would not be drawn on the subject, and Arcturus left him to his silence as they made their way deeper into the complex. They arrived at an elevator and traveled to the surface within its gleaming silver-steel interior. The elevator emerged into the wide hallway of a sizable dwelling, not unlike that of the Menx summer villa. The walls were white marble, and the floor was a mixture of gleaming hardwood and expensive-looking rugs. An iron screw stair led back down into the rock, and a wide set of carpeted stairs led up toward a second story. A shining dome pierced with panels of stained glass surmounted the hallway, and a chandelier of flickering candles floated beneath its curve.
"Very nice," said Arcturus, as Aelin Pasteur led him toward a thick wooden door.
Pasteur opened the door and indicated that Arcturus should step through. Arcturus swept past and entered a long room set with expensive furniture, and a crackling fire that burned beneath a wide mantle. The smell of hot coffee and sweet fruits hung in the air, and Arcturus saw Juliana sitting in a large chair beside the fireplace. She looked up as he entered, and her face transformed, surprisingly, with genuine pleasure at the sight of him. In the intervening years, Juliana had grown up. Features that were girlish and coquettish when he'd last seen her were now womanly and strong. Juliana had lost nothing of her figure, and when she stood and straightened her dress, Arcturus was again reminded of the poise and grace of his mother. Arcturus stepped farther into the room, then pulled up short as he saw a young boy sitting on the floor in front of the fire. Dressed in dark trousers and a matching shirt, his shoulder-length golden hair was pulled back in a small ponytail. Arcturus was no expert in such matters, but he guessed the boy's age at around 6 or 7. The boy sat in the midst of a pile of colored plastic bricks, built as though he had decided to construct a ruined city. Tiny toy soldiers were scattered through these ruins, and Arcturus watched the child move them while making shooting noises with his mouth.
"We have company," said Juliana, and the child looked up.
Arcturus received a dazzling smile from the boy and felt like he'd been kicked in the stomach. Startlingly handsome, the child was blessed with high cheekbones, wide gray eyes, creamy skin, and just the hint of a hawkish curve to his nose.
"What's going on here?"
hissed Arcturus as Aelin Pasteur shut the door behind him.
"Valerian," said Juliana, "say hello to your father."
Book 3. Valerian. Chapter 13. Valerian's eyes flickered, and Aelin Pasteur smiled as he watched the lad fight the tiredness that threatened to overcome him. It had been a long day, and emotions had been running high as they awaited the arrival of Arcturus's ship. His grandson had been excited enough for all of them, which wasn't surprising, given the inflated stories Juliana had filled his head with over the last 7 years. Aelin sat on the side of Valerian's bed, smiling as his grandson blinked furiously at the onset of sleep.
"But I'm not tired, Grandpa," said Valerian. "Why can't I speak to my dad? I've waited all day for him."
"Then one more night's sleep won't hurt, will it? He'll still be here in the morning."
Aelin dearly hoped that was true, for if he'd learned anything about Arcturus from speaking with Angus and Catherine, it was that their son was inclined to be capricious when it came to remaining in one place for any length of time.
"He's just like I imagined him," said Valerian,
and Aelin Pastor fought to keep the worry from his face. Juliana had built up the boy's expectations of his father since his birth, despite Aelin's warnings to her not to do so. It was a source of constant bafflement to Aelin how Juliana could still hold a torch for Arcturus, given how terribly he had treated her, albeit part of that mistreatment was through ignorance of Valerian's existence. He still remembered the day Juliana had told him she was pregnant. Pride and joy were mixed with anger and fear, as he realized that Juliana wasn't going to tell Arcturus that he was to be a father. To this day he couldn't understand or dent her reasoning, founded as it was on years of adoration from afar. They had argued furiously about her refusal to tell Arcturus of her pregnancy, those arguments only ending when Juliana had threatened to leave and never allow him to see her child should he so much as breathe a word to any of the Menksks. Faced with such an ultimatum, what could any father do but accede? In Juliana's worldview, Arcturus had things he had to do on his quest for greatness, and she couldn't distract him until the time was right. Now that Arcturus had left the military, that time had apparently arrived. Though it had been galling to see his daughter give up on her nascent legal career in favor of impending motherhood, Juliana was happy, and he couldn't deny the pleasure he took from seeing that happiness. When Valerian had been born, it seemed her joy was complete. Aelin adored the boy, but then Valerian was easy to love, blessed as he was with his mother's grace and his father's strong features. As Valerian had grown, he began to display a quick wit and a devilish streak that Aelin knew only too well from his trips to Korhal and previous encounters with the Menk's family. Only once or twice had Aelin sensed his daughter's regret at her abandonment of her career, but all she had to do was look into Valerian's beautiful face, and it was swept away in a rush of adoration. After the sudden and shocking introduction to his son, Arcturus had gone quite pale and, for once, been lost for a scathing retort. A master of reading people's emotions, Aelin had seen the anger building in Arcturus and whisked Valerian away from the ugly drama that was no doubt unfolding below. Valerian had protested, but Aelin had learned to be the firm hand in Valerian's life that his mother most certainly was not.
"Is Dad going to live with us now?"
asked Valerian, breaking into Aelin's thoughts.
"I don't know, Val," said Aelin, unwilling to sugar his response. Valerian's mother did enough of that. "He's just arrived, and I don't know what he's going to do."
"Mom wants him to stay."
"I expect you're right, but try not to worry about it. Get some sleep, eh?"
"Where's my dad been?"
asked Valerian with the relentless curiosity of a child.
"He's been in the army, Valerian."
"Fighting bad men or aliens?"
Aliens. It always came back to aliens with Valerian. Ever since Aelin had, under protest, read him a bedtime story about invading creatures from another world, the boy had been fascinated by the idea that other life forms might once have existed, or might still exist, somewhere in the galaxy. Aelin and Juliana had taken Valerian as a young child, under armed escort, of course, to the far canyons and riverbeds of Umoja in search of relics of those lost civilizations. Undaunted by his singular lack of success, Valerian had nevertheless excavated a host of ancient artifacts. Oddly contoured rocks, petrified bark, and the shells of dead creatures he proudly claimed to be the remains of aliens.
"No, Valerian, I don't think your father was fighting aliens."
"So who is he fighting?"
"That's kind of hard to answer,"
said Aelin, trying to think of a way to explain where Valerian's father had been and what he had been doing without upsetting the youngster. As much as Aelin hated the institution of the Confederate Marine Corps, he did not want to rob Valerian of his idealized image of his father before he'd even met the man properly and formed his own opinion. Arcturus would disabuse the boy of any heroic notion soon enough, anyway, he thought.
"I bet my dad's a war hero," said Valerian. "I bet he killed hundreds of men."
"I'm sure he did," said Aelin.
"But he's not a soldier anymore, is he?"
"No, not anymore."
"So what does he do now?" asked Valerian. "Mum just tells me he's doing great work, but I don't really know what that means."
"I'm told he's been a prospector out on the fringe world since he left the army," said Aelin. "Quite a good one, too, by all accounts."
"Is he rich?"
"I'm not sure, but from the sound of it, I think he might be soon."
"Good," declared Valerian. "I want to be rich, too."
Aelin smiled.
"You know, we're not exactly poor here, Valerian."
"I know, but I want to find aliens when I grow up, and I'm going to need a lot of money to do that, aren't I?"
"I suspect you might," Aelin said, laughing. "You'll need a fleet of spaceships, the best archaeologists money can buy, and all sorts of tools."
"Oh, I won't need archaeologists. I want to do the digging myself."
"Really?"
"Of course," said Valerian. "If anyone's going to find aliens, I don't want it to be anyone except me. Where would the fun be in that?"
"I suppose you're right."
"I hadn't thought of that," said Aelin, pride and love filling his heart at the excitement in Valerian's face.
"Now go to sleep, Val. You've got a big day tomorrow."
"Yes,"
said Valerian, pulling the covers tightly around him with a contented smile as his eyes drifted shut.
"I'm going to meet my dad tomorrow."
Aelin Pastor rose from the bed and turned off the light beside Valerian's bed. He made his way to the door and slipped from his grandson's room.
"Yes," he said, "you're going to meet your father. I just hope he's all you hope for."
Arcturus still couldn't quite believe it. He was a father. He was a father. How was the first question that leapt to mind, swiftly followed by a mental kick to the backside. "How do you think it happened, idiot?" He wanted to say something, but the words wouldn't come. He wanted to deny it, but the cast of the boy's countenance was unmistakable. Every curve of feature was that of a Manxk, and the analytical part of Arcturus's brain had seen that the boy was a handsome lad indeed, obscenely gifted with the best genes his parents had to offer. No sooner had Aelin led the boy away than Juliana said something. Arcturus didn't hear it. His head was filled with the white noise of a million questions and the rush of blood around his body. The crackling of the fire was like the roar of a great inferno, and he felt the air in his lungs rasping along his throat and from his mouth. Juliana rose from her chair with a pained expression and crossed the room toward him with her arms outstretched. Without thinking, he took her in his arms and held her as she rested her head on his shoulder and whispered things he couldn't understand. He stood like that for several moments before the reality of the situation washed over him in a tsunami of anger and betrayal. Arcturus took hold of Juliana's arms and pushed her away, as though she were contaminated with some vile plague.
"I have a son," he said, striding away from her.
"Yes," said Juliana, smiling broadly.
You have a wonderful son. His name is Valerian.
A good name, said Arcturus. Strong.
Juliana nodded.
I knew you'd be pleased with that. It suits him, too.
Arcturus was pleased with the name, but more pressing concerns needed to be addressed.
Why the hell didn't you tell me? He said. You kept this from me for all these years? Why would you do that, Juliana? Why?
She recoiled from his anger, and he saw the fear in her eyes. Normally such behavior would have repulsed him, but now he relished it, wanting to hurt her for the insult of keeping a secret from him. And what a secret!
Answer me, damn you! Snapped Arcturus when she turned away from him and stepped close to the fireplace.
She held on to the mantelpiece and coughed into a handkerchief before turning to face him.
I thought you'd be pleased, she said.
Pleased? That you've lied to me and kept the fact that we have a child together? What the hell did you expect? That I'd be pleased with this? That I'd be happy to know I was a father just when my life is taking off the way I've always dreamed?
That's why I couldn't tell you before now, cried Juliana. All those great plans and dreams you told me, I knew I couldn't get in the way until you were ready to realize them. I knew you just joined the Marine Corps to punish your father, and I couldn't tell you about Valerian while you were fighting in the Guild Wars.
Why not?
Said Arcturus, spying a drinks tray on the sideboard and pouring himself a hefty measure of something amber and pungent.
Knowing you had a son would have made your life so much harder.
Arcturus took a belt of strong liquor.
What are you talking about?
I didn't want you thinking of anything except staying alive, Arcturus. I didn't want to do anything that might distract you and get you killed. But now you're out of the military, and I asked my father to keep tabs on how you were doing.
Arcturus poured himself another glass of liquor, deciding that it was some kind of brandy. He hoped it was expensive and old.
If you've been keeping tabs on me, then you'll know we just hit the biggest mineral find I've ever heard of. My mining crew are working it as we speak. And I should be with them. I'm on the brink of achieving everything I wanted, and you drop this in my lap? Well, thank you very much for that, Juliana. Your timing is exquisite.
A fire flashed to life in her eyes.
You don't think I had dreams too, Arcturus? Remember, I had just started with that law firm as a paralegal. I was doing well there, and I had a promising career there until I fell pregnant.
Not a very progressive firm if they fired you for something like that, said Arcturus. You should have sued.
They didn't fire me, thank you very much, snapped Juliana. They wanted me to come back after Valerian was born, but I wanted to devote myself to our child.
Very commendable, said Arcturus,
pouring a third drink. He could already feel the spikes of his anger being worn smooth by its potency.
Valerian is very like you, Arcturus. He's brilliant, charming, and utterly determined in everything he does. You'll like him. I know you will.
Arcturus brushed that thought aside, still reeling from the idea of having a young son and the fact that he didn't know him at all. 7 years of the boy's life had passed, and until now, neither he nor Valerian had ever laid eyes on the other.
"Does my father know? My mother, Dorothy?"
Juliana shook her head.
"No. I wanted to tell you first. It wasn't my place to tell your family about Valerian."
"True," said Arcturus, lapsing into silence for a moment, as a thought occurred to him.
"What is it?"
asked Juliana, seeing a dawning realization in his face.
"It was on Tirador 9, wasn't it?"
he said.
"Can you remember any other time you slept with me?"
"Of course not. Don't be so melodramatic, I was thinking aloud," said Arcturus. "Give me a damn moment to get my thoughts straight. You can't spring something like this on me and expect me to be rational just yet.
He reached for another drink, then thought the better of it. He replaced the glass and began to pace the length of the room, running a hand through his hair as he did so.
"Rational?" said Juliana. "What is there to be rational about? You have a son, and you have a chance to get to know him, to get to know me again. We can be a family now."
"A family?" said Arcturus, halting before her. Is that what you want of me? To leave everything behind and come and live on Umoja with you and the boy?"
"His name is Valerian."
"I know what his name is, Juliana."
"Then why are you afraid to say it?" she countered. "Are you afraid that if you say his name, you'll have to acknowledge him? That he'll become real to you?"
"No, of course not. Don't be absurd."
"Then why won't you say his name?"
"Valerian," said Arcturus. "Valerian, Valerian, Valerian. There, are you happy now?"
Juliana slapped him across the cheek, and he had to restrain the urge to slap her back. He remembered a similarly stinging blow delivered by his mother. In hindsight, he'd realized he'd deserved that one, and he was forced to admit he probably deserved this one, too.
"I'm sorry, Juliana," he said at last, "but I can't leave everything I'm building to come and play happy family with you. I just can't."
"Then what? You're just going to leave like you always do? Run away instead of face up to things?"
"I don't run from things," warned Arcturus.
"Of course you do," said Juliana. "You joined the Marine Corps to run away from your father, and you ran away from me just when we were getting close, and now you're going to run away from your son, your heir."
Juliana's words hit home like hammer blows as he saw the truth of them. Rather than facing up to the events that stood at the crossroads of his life, he had turned from them and chosen the path of least resistance. Would this be another such moment? Arcturus stood on the brink of everything he had ever wanted, but what good was any of it if it was built on foundations of shifting sand? Perhaps now was the time to take stock of his life and look to his legacy. After all, his father had been only a couple of years older than Arcturus was now when he had been handed his son.
"Very well, Juliana," he said at last. "I'll stay. I will talk to Valerian. I get to know him, and he will be my heir, as you say."
She threw herself at him and wrapped her arms around him once more.
"I'm so happy. I knew that once you saw Valerian, you'd want to be part of his life."
Again, Arcturus pried Juliana from him, though with less force than the last time.
"Don't let's get ahead of ourselves now," he said. "I said I'll get to know him, but I still don't know if I'm ready to just give up on everything I've built."
"I'm not asking you to,"
said Juliana, cupping his chin in her hands and pressing her face close to his.
"Can't you see that? You don't have to give anything up. We can all be together, all of us. We can have everything we ever dreamed of. All those grand plans you told me over the years, they're coming to fruition now, right now. You just have to want to see it."
Arcturus smiled. Perhaps Juliana's words had merit, or perhaps it was the alcohol flowing around his system. But whatever it was, Arcturus was surprised to find the idea didn't horrify him. Perhaps they could be a normal family after all. Arcturus awoke with a thick head and a brief dislocation as he wondered where he was. He was refreshed and his limbs felt gloriously rested. The prefabricated crew quarters of a mining claim or the cramped confines of a starship weren't exactly conducive to uninterrupted sleep, and he'd forgotten just how nice it was to spend a night in a soft bed. He stretched and rolled his neck on the pillow, enjoying the warmth and letting the aches of the last 6 months ease from his bones. He smiled. And then the blissful forgetfulness of waking was replaced with the cold, hard remembrances of the previous night's events as everything came rushing back. Juliana, Valerian, his son. The gentle ease of morning fled from his body, and he pushed himself upright, looking around the wood-paneled room with its tasteful furniture, heavy curtains, and discreetly situated technology. The functionality of the room was pure Umoja, and the silver of dusty orange sky he could see through the window only confirmed it.